Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
My computer makes me feel smarter. It provides quick calculations and instant access to information I couldn't call to mind on my own right away. What if we could give our computers the power to get smarter by learning from experience? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Take the ongoing effort to build a driverless car. Already, these machines are better than many human motorists at calculating routes, maneuvering through space, and following traffic laws. They are less great at dealing with the unexpected judgment calls humans respond easily to, like interpreting police officers' commands directing traffic or deciding how to steer to minimize damage in the event that a collision is inevitable. But if we could create a computer that learned by experience and observation what we need and want it to do in these special situations, and then gave it the ability to program itself to do what's needed, we could effectively invent the perfect driver. What we need is the right instructions to tell that computer how to learn and then how to act on that information. Pedro Domingos is professor of computer science at the University of Washington. He explores this idea and many others in his new book, The Master Algorithm: How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Pedro, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Start at the beginning, if you would. The word algorithm gets tossed around a lot these days. It may still be a little confusing to people outside the world of computer science. What is an algorithm in general?
Sure. An algorithm is just how we tell computers what we want them to do, right? If I want the computer to, let's say I wanted the computer to bake a cake, let's say it was a robot, right? I would give it a recipe. So an algorithm in a way is like a kind of recipe for the information processing that the computer has to do, except it's much more detailed and much more precise than a recipe or a set of instructions that you would give to a human, because computers are very dumb, so we need to explain everything in minute detail. But that's really all that an algorithm is. It could be, in English, except it has to be in a programming language so the computers can understand it.
You say that all knowledge, past, present, and future, can be derived from data by a single universal learning algorithm.
Yep. That's the main hypothesis that the book is built around. So this master algorithm is a new type of algorithm, which is a learning algorithm, right? As you were just, talking about. The idea is that in the same way that people can learn from experience, right? I can figure out how to do something because somebody explained it to me. Somebody gave me the instructions, or I can figure out, for example, how to bake a new cake because I just created it, or I ate it at a restaurant and then I figured out, what were the ingredients and how they put together. So that's learning on your own. And the exciting thing that's happening these days is that computers are starting to be able to learn on their own. And the question is how far we can take that. And, and what I believe based on a lot of evidence and a lot of other people believe is that there is essentially no limit to how far this can go. In the limit, a computer could learn everything that we can learn and maybe more.
We already know that algorithms are being used to manage data and suggest things we might like in applications like Netflix and Pandora, which are maybe just the earliest iteration of some of this. When we had a master algorithm, we could apply it to anything and the same algorithm could be used to solve any problem?
Exactly. This is the amazing thing about machine learning is that it's the same algorithm doing, 500 different things, right? In traditional computer science, if you want an algorithm to do credit scoring, you need to program, the computer, what factors should you take into account in deciding whether somebody gets credit and how should you combine them. If you want the algorithm to play chess, you have to program it to play chess. The amazing thing about a learning algorithm is that it's the same algorithm that does all of these different things. The reason it can behave differently is that it can look at the data, right? It will watch chess games. It will, play chess games against itself and figure out what to do. If it's being asked to do credit scoring, it will learn from, people's credit records and whether or not they pay their debts and whatnot. So the one algorithm can do an unlimited number of things.
Would that master algorithm involve something akin to consciousness?
Not necessarily, right? So the master algorithm is a learning algorithm, right? And you could potentially learn a lot of things without being conscious. However, if you wanted this algorithm to learn the kinds of common sense knowledge that people acquire by, by living in the world and doing things and interacting with other people, you would have to put that algorithm in the brain of a robot And that robot would, I think, for all intents and purposes, be conscious, right? Now, there's a deep philosophical question of whether, let's say this robot is acting, you know, it's completely indistinguishable from a conscious being. Is it really, really conscious? You know, this is sometimes called the hard problem of consciousness. How can I really tell? But I think for all, you know, intents and purposes, it would be consciousness. It would have the same percepts. It would process things the same way. It would have the same responses. And I think people would treat it as being conscious in the same way that we treat each other as being conscious, right? You're not sure that I'm conscious. The only person you're sure of in the world that is conscious is you, but we're similar enough that you kind of, you know, are willing to assume that I'm conscious, right? And I think people will do the same thing with robots.
Which comes first, a full understanding of how human brains work and process information that can be given to a computer via a master algorithm, or a master algorithm that sort of turns back around and tells us about how our brains work?
Yeah, that is a great question. So there are some people whose, you know, favorite route to the master algorithm is to reverse engineer the human brain. You know, people like Ray Kurzweil, for example, and Jeff Hawkins, their whole bet is that, you know, we're going to reverse engineer the brain and figure out how our learning works and how intelligence works that way. I actually don't think that approach is the more promising one, because understanding the brain is extremely difficult, right? The brain is super complicated, and it does a lot of other things besides learning. And it probably also has a lot of, you know, evolutionary cruft, you know, like, you know, the fact that, for example, the optic nerve, you know, actually creates a blind spot that's completely unnecessary in the retina because it comes out the wrong way. Crazy things like that. There's probably things like that in the brain as well. So, you know, if we understood the brain today, we could probably extract from it, you know, the master algorithm. But that's kind of like a very, you know, difficult and roundabout way to go about it. I think we're better off figuring out how you know, how to learn. Partly, I think we can take the brain and neuroscience into account, but also things like psychology, right? I think there's a lot of great evidence from psychology that we can use. And also just engineering, right? A lot of the reason why the progress in machine learning has been so fast is that we can just try it out on a lot of data repeatedly, you know, like minute by minute, and figure out what works very quickly and what doesn't work as well. So I think we will get to the master algorithm, you know, faster that way. And then there's another very interesting twist, which is the following. The way people are trying to understand the brain, and at the end of the day, the only way that they're going to understand it is by figuring out what the structure of the network is, right? The brain is this huge network of, you know, tens of billions of neurons, and there's this field now called connectomics where they are literally trying to build a map of the brain, right? And once you've reversed engineered the brain, so to speak, you can start figuring out what it is that it's doing. But here's the twist, is that the amount of information that they have is so large, And the network is so tangled that the only way they are able to actually extract the map of the neurons from the images and the slices that they get is by using machine learning. So without machine learning, the effort to understand the brain will not succeed. So I think they can both benefit from each other, but at the end of the day, in more than one way, machine learning and sort of like the master algorithm is the more essential of the two.
Would the achievement of a master algorithm confirm that human free will is an illusion?
No, well, I think you could argue that human free will is an illusion regardless of whether we achieve the master algorithm, right? I think this is an interesting question, right? Because at some level, if the laws of physics hold, there is no such thing as free will, right? However, I think there are two important caveats, and they relate to this question of algorithms. One is that we know now that, you know, even though the world in theory is deterministic, in practice, it's impossible to predict things. You know, the world is chaotic, right? Things diverge very quickly from, you know, from a starting point that might be only minutely different. And a lot of this kind of like non-determinism seems to be concentrated in the human brain. So even though in theory there's no free will, in practice, in some ways there is, right? And now this feeling that we have that we kind of like determine our actions, right? A lot of people have said, well, your brain has already decided what to do before you feel that you're deciding. And that may be true. But nevertheless, I think at the end of the day, the most important thing about free will is that free will means that you're accountable for your actions. Whatever the physics and the neuroscience and the computer science, I think making people accountable for their actions makes them, you know, more responsible, and it makes them choose better actions. So in the end, the important thing about free will is not whether it's really true or not, is that it's a useful thing for us to think of ourselves in terms of. Now, how does that relate to things like learning algorithms, right? Learning algorithms are deterministic, right? They were programmed by us. But I think once they get rich enough and complex enough, their behavior will start to look very similar to the behavior of someone who has free will. And I think, again, as with consciousness, we will start to treat the computers as if they have free will, whether or not they really do at the end of the day.
Petra, what are the challenges of programming in something like judgment that we value ourselves for and think we do better often than a computer?
Yeah, so it can be very challenging. There are some judgments that are surprisingly easy for a computer to make, right? Where a lot of the successes of machine learning have been is in things like, for example, credit scoring, right? Banks used to have loan officers to decide whether to, you know, to give you a loan. And the loan officers thought of themselves as having a lot of very deep knowledge and experience and applying it and whatnot. And then along comes this very simple algorithm. You give it a database of credit records, and then, you know, in 5 minutes, it learns to do better than the loan officer, right? So there are certain kinds of judgments that are easier than they seem to be. And that's why a lot of, for example, white-collar jobs these days are being replaced by machine learning algorithms. However, on the other hand, there are also kinds of judgment that are extremely difficult for machines to make, and they can't make them today. These are the judgments that require a lot of common sense knowledge, the knowledge of how the world works that we take for granted, but that we use constantly in our daily lives, but computers don't have. Now, because there are these vast amounts of data and the computers can learn from them, they're getting better at this, and definitely there's more and more things that they can do. But at the end of the day, I think to have all the common sense that people have, and therefore to be able to make all the, you know, all the correct judgments that people make, you're going to have the learning that really comes from living a life in the world, from interacting with people, from doing things. And that, I think, is going to come from having robots, right? A self-driving car is a robot in the shape of the car, and the Roomba is a robot, and they're going to get progressively more sophisticated, and they're going to share their data instantly, right? Because they can do that much more easily than people can. And I think with that, I think over the next, you know, years, we're going to see the computers getting more and more common sense and therefore also getting better and better at making these judgments that currently only people can make.
So we need to have robots out in the world, because otherwise there's no way that we could think to give them all the data that we naturally have acquired without realizing it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be fair, there's more than one school of thought on this. Mm-hmm. There's a set of people who believe that you can endow computers with all the common sense that they need just by having them, you know, read the web, read a lot of books, read textbooks, because a lot of that knowledge is somebody wrote it down somewhere. And that's an easier path, right? Because it doesn't involve all the messiness of building actual robots and having them stumble around in the real world. And I think you can get some mileage out of that. And indeed, you know, like all these big companies like Google, for example, have these projects like Google's Knowledge Graph, where the goal is to read the web and learn from that and turn it into a form that the computer can then reason with and answer questions and whatnot. I think, however, that at the end of the day, all of the common sense that we need is not easily extracted from those things, often because they presume it, right? When somebody writes a book, or a news story, right? They don't explain things that they know you already know. Hmm. Unfortunately, those are the things that the computers also need to know. So I think in the end, it's going to take this experience in the real world. There's also people who say like, oh, we're going to, you know, literally manually program into the computer all the common sense knowledge that it needs to have. And, you know, there was this famous project called Psyche, led by Doug Lenat, where the goal was to manually input all the knowledge, but it failed, unfortunately. So I think we're going to need robots.
We're speaking this hour with Pedro Domingos, who is a professor of computer science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, you can call 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Computer Science at the University of Washington, Pedro Domingos. His new book is called The Master Algorithm: How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Join us at 800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Pedro, thinking about all these little common sense things, there are millions of them. Like, for example, we all sort of know that most doorknobs open by turning to the left, but we also know that occasionally you find one that was installed incorrectly and you have to turn that one to the right. And we also know that sometimes there's a doorknob that you just have to jiggle a little and then it will open. That's hard to pre-program into an algorithm.
No, exactly. Those are exactly the kinds of things that tend to defeat computers. And this is why the Psyche project failed, because they said, oh, we need 10,000 rules, and then it was 100,000, and then it's a million, and then in the end it's infinity. This is, however, what machine learning makes possible, right? Because the robots can, just like humans do, right? You start out turning your doorknobs to the right, and then one day you realize that you have to turn it to the left. And little by little, you accumulate sort of like this knowledge by these things having happened to you and you having had to figure them out. But people are very flexible in how they can do this. And really, the whole question for machine learning is, can we make the learning algorithms as flexible as people are? And, you know, that's what the goal of the master algorithm is. And, you know, we're not there yet, but we're making progress.
Should we worry that algorithms will do too much thinking for us and actually keep us from being exposed to ideas or facts or experiences that we might need to help us learn as we go through life?
Yeah, I think we should, right? I think as with all technology, you know, machine learning can do great things for us, right? It's like, you know, it's like all other technology, like giving us these powers in like you were talking about, like the power to, you know, computers give you super memory, right? You can know all these things that you wouldn't know otherwise. And they let us, you know, think very fast. And you know, machine learning algorithms let us learn and let us predict things, right? Machine learning algorithms can predict a lot of things. At the same time, it's easy to get too comfortable with the technology and to get complacent. And in some ways, you know, once a computer starts to do something, maybe you don't need to do it yourself, right? You know, do you really need to do arithmetic? Some people say yes. Some people say there's no need because the computer does it. But the thing is that we should be clear on our minds what thinking should be done by the machines and what thinking should be done by us. And if we leave to the machines the thinking that should be done by us, we're in trouble. Or maybe those of us who don't realize that are in trouble vis-a-vis the ones who are, you know, more aware of how things should go. And I think the basic division of labor that should happen between people and computers is that we should be the ones setting the goals. If the computers start setting the goals, I think things are going off track. We should tell, you know, the computers what we want them to do for us. And then the computers can use all their intelligence and all their thinking to go figure out the answer, maybe in ways that would be beyond us. And the computers can also, you know, as they already do, right, they can make suggestions. They say, well, you know, here's what I think you might want to do. Here's something that you might want to be aware of. But I think at the end of the day, you know, there's no replacement for your own judgment. And so we should, in some sense, let the computers do the grunge work of thinking. But the real deep choices, I think, will always have to be made by us.
Of course, when you say we and us, that sort of assumes this magical utopia where all of humankind is on the same page about what's important and how things should proceed. I can imagine a utopia or a dystopia in the future with a master algorithm based, for one thing, on who's in charge of this thing, who perfects it first. Would it be a government? Would it be a private corporation? And what would the implications be of either one?
No, exactly. So just to be clear, you know, you're right. When I say we, this is gluing together a lot of things, right? I think what's really going to happen, and again, this is part of what people need to be aware of how things are going to play out, is that there is going to be no such utopia where everybody's on the same page, right? Because it's human nature. So we means, for example, I need to figure out what I want from these algorithms. Somebody else needs to figure out what they want. And for example, you know, most of these algorithms that are learning models of you and me today are in the hands of companies. And in some ways, there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, they're trying to serve you better. But in some ways, they have a conflict of interest. You know, like, for example, Google, right? You know, Sergey Brin says it wants to be the third half of your brain, which sounds great. But, you know, the third half of your brain has a conflict of interest because it wants to sell you ads.
Right.
And you know, there's many, many examples like this. You know, an example of this is in politics, right? These days, machine learning is used in politics to predict, you know, how you can persuade voters to vote for you. And this is actually a large part of how, for example, you know, Obama beat Romney. So if you're not aware of what's going on and don't take the reins, somebody else will take them for you, right? So I think at the end of the day, you know, once this future, you know, takes shape, and it is taking shape now, we're still going to have the same conflicts, the same collaborations, the same, you know, all the different things that happen, you know, in society today, you know, different groups that make alliances or that fight each other. It's just that the ones that have machine learning will be much more powerful than the ones that don't. Just like today, you know, somebody who can use computers has a huge advantage to someone who can't or any other technology.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone to Todd in Louisville. Hi, Todd.
Well, good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, my question is, and it's really kind of a philosophical question, and that is, you know, it's always been thought that the human mind is a thing that cannot know itself. So how can this algorithm idea be an idea that could know itself?
Yeah, so you know, there's a saying which is very fun, right? That if we were so simple that we could understand ourselves, we'd be so stupid that we couldn't, right? Right? Think about it, right?
Yeah.
That makes sense at some level, and this is an argument against AI, you know, or machine learning being possible, right? Now, I don't think that is actually a showstopper, and that's for a very simple reason, which is it's not just me trying to understand my brain on my own. It's the effort of thousands or tens of thousands of scientists over many decades trying to understand one brain, right? And now I think we can actually be smart enough to understand ourselves even though we're complicated. But nevertheless, I think if somebody asked me what is the most likely reason why something like AI, you know, like we're trying to, you know, make AI that is as intelligent as humans, and, you know, definitely machine learning, you know, at this point it's clear that it has to be done with machine learning. But if somebody asks, what is the most likely reason for things to fail? And I would say is that, yes, maybe even with all of that, we are too complex for us to be able to figure it out. But the only way we're going to find out is by trying, right? You know, I think the master algorithm will be able to have, you know, powers of self-examination. There are already, you know, simpler programs that have those powers, right? They can look at their own state and they can even change themselves, right? So there are programs today that can change themselves and you know, and they're still quite simple. Now, that by itself, I don't think is going to be enough to get us there, but we'll see what it is that we have to do.
Of course, a master algorithm could learn from experience, but there are things that are novel. How would something like this deal with a problem that was brand new? Would it have the ability to innovate in the moment to respond to something in the way that a person would, you know, duck if a cup flew across the room?
No, exactly. So it better, right? Otherwise, it's not the master algorithm.
Right.
The question is how, right? And one of the ways that people, build machine learning algorithms is this notion of reasoning by analogy, right? Human beings constantly reason by analogy, and that's often how they are able to deal with novel situations, is that we are amazing at just, you know, taking something that's happening that we haven't seen before and somehow figuring out how to reduce it to things that we have seen before, maybe combined with a different way or with one or two new elements, and then kind of like taking the solution from the cases that we know to the ones that we don't know. And you know, there is one school of machine learning that, you know, their master algorithm is reasoning by analogy. And it does have this property that it's much more able to respond to brand new situations than some of the other methods that are based on having, you know, mountains and mountains of data. And I think that is very much one part of the master algorithm. There are others as well.
We have a tweet here from Stephen who asks, do Asimov's laws of robotics figure into today's work toward AI advancement? I love robots, but I do have safety concerns.
No, they do. And in fact, you know, there's a lot of debate as we are now, right, after many years, really starting to see robots really, you know, in the world, right, interacting with people, like, for example, you know, with the case of Roombas and self-driving cars and whatnot. And so there's a lot of debate about, you know, what do we need to program into these robots? You know, what are the, you know, ethical principles to make sure that they don't go awry and do bad things, right? A very, salient example is the use of robots in warfare, right? Now, you know, because of drones and how the drones are becoming more and more autonomous, and in some cases they're already, you know, some countries have drones that have the ability to fire on somebody without asking a human being for permission. So, you know, this could be a slippery slope to something very bad, or it could actually be better if the robots, you know, actually keep their heads more than humans do and you know, are more precise and careful about deciding where to shoot and whatnot. But, you know, Asimov's laws are actually sort of like a very prominent framework for how to do this. And I think that, you know, in the main, the laws are right. The problem is that they're incomplete, right? Just knowing those laws doesn't take you all the way to how you put them into practice. And of course, the irony is that, you know, if you look at Asimov's stories in the, you know, in iRobot and, you know, all these stories where he used those laws, almost every one of those stories, the thing that drives the plot is a failure of the three laws. It's, you know, the robot finds a contradiction, or there's something that, you know, it's not clear how it fits into those laws, right? So you have a lot of these interesting situations, and the real robots are going to have to deal with them. And again, there's no hope of programming all the rules into them. However, again, I think part of the solution for this is to use machine learning. The robots can learn what to do by observing people. However, I think if the robots start observing us, you know, just sort of like in a very, you know, factual way, they might be very confused, right? Because we have all these moral principles, but then most of the time we don't actually obey them, right? So in some ways, I think what the robots are going to force us to do is to actually confront, is make us learn more about ourselves and what we really mean, you know, by ethical behavior and by morality and you know, in some ways, I think at the end of the day, we're going to learn from the machines as much as they're going to learn from us.
Can you imagine learning computers could someday serve on juries? Would they be better able to process the information they were given and determine guilt or innocence?
Yeah, definitely. And in fact, some of that is actually already happening in the following sense, right? You know, judges have a certain amount of sentencing leeway. And one of the things that you want to do is, you know, ponder whether someone is a risk to society if you let them out earlier, right? How likely are they to commit crime again? And there's already, you know, several states and countries where, you know, judges use machine learning algorithms to predict how likely someone is to commit a crime, you know, if they are released. And then that doesn't make the decision all by itself, of course, but it's a factor that goes into deciding how long their sentence will be. And, you know, looking forward into the future, I can well see a place for algorithms in juries. And, you know, some people might say, oh, but that's machines making, you know, life and death decisions about people. That sounds a little dangerous. And, you know, as with everything, you know, we have to be careful how we do that. But here's the thing is that a machine in some ways can be much more objective, you know, less biased, more impartial, more thoughtful, can take the evidence, in, more evidence into account and look at it in more ways than human beings do. So so maybe in some ways, you know, the machines can, even if not necessarily make the decisions all by themselves, complement people on things like juries, right? You might have some of the, you know, some of the members be machines and some of the members be humans. You know, here's a related example, right? There's a venture fund that has actually, you know, that has the machine learning algorithm as one of its board members right now, right? The machine learning algorithm has a vote along with the human members of the board on what things to invest in.
Wow.
And right, it's like, which makes perfect sense because this algorithm's already being used, you know, to make, you know, buy and sell decisions. And at some point, why not just have the algorithm, you know, sit on the board? And there's another example, right? If you take the, you know, the GMAT, right, the admissions test for MBA programs, your essay is graded by a human and the computer. And if the human and the learning algorithm agree, then that's it. If they disagree, then there's another human to break the tie.
Hmm.
So I think, yeah, we are going to see more of this, and I think people are going to be surprisingly comfortable with it.
It's funny as we outsource thinking, though. You know, you have a smartphone, and I'm sure you've used Google Maps or Siri to get around. And occasionally, you will get a direction that doesn't seem to make any sense. I find myself thinking, well, the machine must be right. I haven't been in this neighborhood before, even though it appears that the machine is not right. It's odd to me how quickly I've become comfortable with assuming that machine must be correct when I know from experience that sometimes it's not.
No, exactly. I mean, everybody has this experience. And the thing now is that sometimes the machine is right. You know, it was the human that was wrong. But sometimes the human, it's the human that's right and the machine is wrong, you know, for example, because maybe it doesn't have common sense. But here's the thing. Going into the future, the machines are only going to get better, right? They're not going to get worse. So, you know, more and more, it will be the case that the machine is right and you are wrong, and we will just learn to trust them. I think on small, mundane things like, you know, like how to get to where you're going, you know, there's no problem with trusting the machines and they probably will know better. I think on the deeper, you know, things, again, at the end of the day, maybe you still want to trust your judgment, but after, you know, taking under advisement what your personal assistant is saying.
Let's go now to Greg in Dallas. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. You know the old Star Trek TV series, Captain Kirk would be confronted with machines or computers or robots in at least three episodes, and the way he defeated it was to bring up some contradiction, to make the computer recognize an illogic, and that's how he would do it. And so this idea that, I'm not saying you're saying this, but it would scan the web and it would learn from it. There's so much contradictory information out there. There's false information out there. Just on global warming, you know, a bunch of data would say there's global warming and a bunch of data would say there wasn't global warming. I don't know how it would ever figure anything out.
Those are great points, Greg. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, so indeed, you know, this point that you just brought up is exactly what defeated classic AI, right? You know, for 20 or 30 years, people's approach to AI was this approach of just, you know, programming in, you know, everything that you need to know, writing all the rules. But then the problem, right, the killer problem or one of them is that it's hard, you know, to encode all that knowledge. But the other one, these were the two big problems, is exactly this problem of contradictions, right? If the computer is just a logical reasoning engine and it sees a contradiction, then it basically falls apart because in logic, you know, once you have a contradiction, you can infer that whatever you want, that pigs fly and things go very bad very quickly. And in classic AI, people were never able to solve that, but this is where machine learning comes in and can actually handle contradictions.
My guest is Pedro Domingos. He is professor of computer science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Pedro Domingos, who is professor of computer science at the University of Washington and author of The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Pedro, I want to fast forward a little bit and talk about some of the things you think that we might outsource to computers and machines if the Master Algorithm can be developed. What would daily life look like? And what would we not have to handle with our own brains if we had a personal algorithmic avatar moving about the web and in the world for us?
Yeah, well, you know, let me give you an example, which is health, right? You know, these days you get sick and then you go to the doctor and, you know, they try to figure out what you have and hopefully they do. I think, you know, in this world that machine learning is creating, things are going to work very differently. Because, for example, your smartphone is going to be constantly monitoring you and the smartphone will detect the symptoms. And, you know, you may even have sensors inside your body. They will detect the symptoms and they will actually figure out, without you even having to be conscious of it, what the problem is and how to fix it. If your smartphone thinks you're about to have a heart attack, it will, you know, warn you and call 911, you know, on its own. I think this is actually something that's going to happen in the fairly, you know, in the fairly short-term future. In the longer-term future, I think you're going to see things like, you know, there's a new outbreak of something, like, you know, like the next Ebola. And what's going to happen is that it's going to get sequenced very quickly. the vaccine or the cure, you know, whatever it is, will get, you know, published on the internet, and your immune system is going to download the cure from the internet, manufacture the antibodies or whatever it is that needs to happen, and you never got sick, right? Hmm. So in a sense, you know, health problems is going to become an oxymoron because you won't know what they are anymore, because there's all these things happening behind the scenes keeping you healthy. Some of them inside your body, some of them outside, and there's this communication and all this continuous learning going on that you're not aware of. And I think the same idea applies to a lot of other things. What we are going to notice, or maybe not even notice, is that the world adapts itself to us without us actually having to do anything to make that happen, right? You know, humans are the species that adapts the world to itself instead of adapting itself to the world. But what machine learning does is that it takes that to another level. It's that you don't even have to adapt the world to you. It's that the world adapts on its own, right? You know, you walk into a certain space, and this, you know, like whether it's a room, you know, or a car, or whatever, and it automatically adapts itself to you, right? It picks the things that you like, you know, the things that show on the walls, the temperature, et cetera, et cetera. And again, we're already starting to see the beginning of this with things like the Nest, right? It's this learning thermostat that programs itself by seeing what your habits are, you know, what temperature you like, when you're home, when you're not home, and so on and so forth. And, you know, you start with the temperature, and then that goes on to your entire life. So I think the one picture of this is that you will just feel that the world is adapted to you in a way that it isn't now.
I am no Luddite, but I can't help but worry what would happen if this technology fell into the wrong hands. You know, in a world run by an Abraham Lincoln, maybe, you know, a master algorithm would be a good thing. In a world run by someone like Adolf Hitler, it would be just a horrific thing.
No, you're absolutely right. Right. So machine learning is like any other technology. It has enormous potential for good and enormous potential for bad, which is why, you know, it's our job, you know, but in the long run, right, what has happened with technology is that the good prevails over the bad. But that only happens with our effort and our attention to make sure that it's the Abe Lincolns and not the Adolf Hitlers that actually, you know, get a hold of the technology, or that you know, the good guys, you know, get the technology better and farther ahead than the bad guys do. And that we also, you know, decide what to do with it, right? You know, again, it's not just the question of Nazis, you know, or whatever, getting hold of machine learning. Is that in society, there's always different groups that want different things, and they use the power and the tools they have at their disposal. And machine learning, like other technologies, is a very powerful tool. So, you know, if you want to be kind of like on the winning side that benefits from it versus the losing side, you have to, you know what it is and know how to make the best of it. And then there's these decisions that we have to collectively make as a society, you know, and that's what democracy is for, about what are, for example, the limits that we want to put on this and what are the rules, you know, by which it's going to be used and so forth.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ruben on the line in Arlington. Hey, Ruben.
Hi there. I just wanted to make a comment. Earlier, Arthur made a comment about the reverse engineering the human brain, as Ray Kurzweil and others have suggested. My background is in neuroscience. Now, here's the comment that I want to make. It's been a decade since we mapped a simple nematode, C. elegans. It has only 302 neurons in its entire central nervous system. And all the modeling has been able to predict only 20% or so of its functioning of its central nervous system. This simple 302 neuron central nervous system. What makes us think that we can reverse engineer billions of neurons and kind of predict from all those neurons? So I agree with the author that I think going the other way, my background is not in machine learning, but being from the neuroscience point of view, I think a connectome and all that is not going to get us there. So that's what my comment.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I agree with you, right? And in fact, you know, this example of the nematode and its 200 neurons is very famous and justifiably so, because, I mean, even that seems hard to figure out. This is exactly why I think that reverse engineering the brain is not the shortest path to the master algorithm, because you're having to deal with an extraordinary amount of complexity. And the truth is, at the end of the day, the learning algorithms that are embodied in all that neural machinery, If this is like everything else, you can abstract from that what's really going on and also implement it in a different technology, right? Having said that, I think, it is a worthwhile pursuit. I think connectomics is useful because I think, you know, in the past, neuroscience has focused very much on just, you know, figuring out how individual neurons work. But that's only part of the story, right? You also need to figure out how they're connected. But, you know, it is going to be a long road, you know, and I think the people who are pursuing that, like Sebastian Song, you know, they're aware that this is going to be a long road. You know, here's another thing that I find, you know, very interesting, which is, let's suppose that, you know, so we have the nematode brain, if you will. We don't understand how it works yet, right? It's like having the circuit of a TV or a computer and now trying to figure out what is the function that it's performing. And imagine, you know, that we fast forward into the future and then we have the precise map of the human brain, right? We know exactly what kinds of neurons are connected to what others in what area. We got it down. We are still at that point very far from understanding how the brain works. And in fact, the only way I think we're going to understand how the brain, you know, what that circuit, what that big circuit is doing, is by bringing in ideas from psychology and from computer science. Because at the end of the day, right, I don't think you can make sense of that circuit without knowing what it's for, right? You know, these neurons are here to see, and they're here to reason. And, you know, seeing and reasoning and speaking and understanding are, you know, are what psychologists and linguists and people in artificial intelligence study. So I think, you know, these fields are going to have a lot to contribute to neuroscience, even if the goal is just to understand, you know, the human brain.
All right, let's talk about personal data. This is something people have varying degrees of comfort with, you know, sharing out in the world. Of course, a lot of companies are collecting information about us all the time. We know the government may be collecting information about us. You suggest that if we actually want something like a master algorithm to really work for us, we might have to get comfortable with sharing a lot more than even data like our social security number and our birth date, a lot more.
Well, yes. So I think there's two parts to this, right? One is, I think at the end of the day, we are really going to want to have, you know, a very good learned model of us, right? So your smartphone right now is trying to learn everything about you from everything that you do with it. And then, you know, it uses that to answer your questions, to understand what you say, to make suggestions, et cetera, et cetera. And this is incredibly useful, right? And I think in the future, we're not going to be able to live without that. Or, you know, it'll just seem impossible to try to live without a model like that, you know, easing the information overload for you and helping you navigate the world and whatnot. But the problem is that right now, what you have is a bunch of little models learned by different companies from your interactions with them, right? Google learns from your searches, you know, Amazon learns from your, you know, product purchases, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is not that good because each of these models doesn't know you very well. What you want is a model that is learned from all the data that you generate. In the limit, a model learned from your stream of consciousness, right? Video, you know, imagine having something like Google Glass, you know, on all the time. And this thing learns from everything that you do. As a result of which, it winds up knowing you very, very well. And so it can be very helpful. You know, it's like having a new best friend that is actually much more patient than your real best friend is. At the same time, and this is where the danger is, I think you really don't want that very good model of you to be owned by a company, right? Because, or by any, you know, organization, because that gives them too much power over you, right? With that model, it can predict, you know, what you're going to do, at least, you know, to a certain degree, to the extent that it can be predicted. It knows, you know, maybe a lot of things about you that you don't want, you know, to be public. So you want to own that model. So I think part of what, so we need two parts of this, right? We need all of that data to come together to learn that 360-degree model of you. And that, again, is starting to happen because, for example, a lot of your interactions go through your smartphone and, you know, and so Apple or Google or whatever, you know, can capture that and use it. And they are in a race to try to make the most of that. But at the same time, I think people need to become aware of this in a way that they're not yet. And they need to say, no, I want to be the owner of that model. Another question is, how's that going to happen, right? I think, you know, one way that that could happen is that there's going to be a new kind of company that's a little bit to your data like the bank is to your money, right? The bank is different from you, but it, you know, usually bankers don't run away with your money because they know that would be the end of their business. And I think we're going to see something similar with your data. There's a company that maybe you pay a subscription fee to, and it gathers all your data and it learns that model of you, and then it applies that model on your behalf for all sorts of things. This is one version. Another version, you know, that I mentioned in the book is maybe something like a data union, where a bunch of like-minded people get together. And, you know, this could be people all over the world, right? You just sign up for this data union. And what you sign up for is you and all the other 100,000 or 10 million people in it, you pool your data, and then you learn models of the other entities that you interact with. Like, you know, like Google's learning a model of me, but maybe I also want to learn a model of Google or of my bank or of, you know, or of the companies that are selling me whatever. We pool all our data, and then the models learned from that data are used by all of us. So being in such a union doesn't mean that, you know, I'm letting other people see my data. It just means that we're sharing the data for purposes of learning these models.
How far away do you think we are in time from something like a master algorithm?
That's a very good question, and it's hard to answer because progress in science isn't linear, right? It's not like we start to, like, progress at a steady pace. Right. We tend to go through long periods, you know, where progress is slow, and then there's like these shorter periods where progress happens very rapidly because there was a breakthrough, and that breakthrough leads to other breakthroughs, and this is exactly what's happening in machine learning right now. So, and the other aspect is that nobody really knows how complicated the master algorithm is going to be. Is it going to be 1,000 lines of code? Is it going to be 1,000,000, right? These are very different things. So it could be that someone, you know, figures it out tomorrow. It could be that it takes many decades and maybe it will never happen, either because there isn't one or because the problem is just too hard. But, you know, like, I think the more people that are thinking about the problem and the more they're thinking about it in different ways, the more likely it is that these breakthroughs will happen. And so one of my hopes in writing the book is that, you know, maybe some kid somewhere will have sort of like this insight that has escaped the people that are kind of like just, you know, already in the field thinking along certain tracks, and that insight will lead to the master algorithm.
Yeah, you write about this early on in the book, that you actually think it's possible that all of the mathematicians and computer scientists might be so focused on certain details that they might be missing something that is, if not obvious, requires a really novel way of approaching it.
Yeah, and you know, number one is a common event in the history of science, right? Is that someone who comes in from the outside with a different perspective actually makes the breakthrough. Because the problem is that when you're already thinking along a certain track, it starts to become harder and harder to see outside it, right? In machine learning, there are these different paradigms, and most people are just thinking inside their paradigm. And if that paradigm is not enough, and I don't think it is, right? I think, number one, we need to unify them, but then there might be other ideas. People who are actually approaching the field from the outside are actually at an advantage. At the same time, you know, in fields like biology and physics, you need so much knowledge. I mean, like, these fields have existed for, you know, 200 years or more. You need so much knowledge before you can, you know, contribute and not just reinvent the wheel, that it's hard for just anybody to come and make an advance. The amazing thing about computer science, though, is that it's such a young field, right? And you know, there's so much flexibility to what you can do with computers. Really, you know, your imagination is the limit, that, you know, even a 19-year-old in a dorm room can come up with a breakthrough. And in fact, you know, this has happened, right? You know, look at Mark Zuckerberg, for example. Right? He was a 19-year-old in a dorm room when he created Facebook, and Bill Gates, and, you know, think of Napster and so on and so forth. So I think it really could happen.
Pedro Domingos is professor of computer science at the University of Washington and author of the new book, The Master Algorithm, How the Quest for the Ultimate Learning Machine Will Remake Our World. Pedro, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.